Welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives, as we bring you some of our favourite conversations from 2021. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight has often been described as a hero, although I've got a feeling he may disagree with that title. In his decades of service within the ranks of Victoria Police, he was honoured with numerous awards, including an Australian Police Medal and the Victoria Police Star. As a crash scene investigator and reconstruction expert with the Major Collision Investigation Unit. His work helped to provide answers for grieving families and communities touched by road trauma. But like so many of his fellow first responders, the legacy of his service left deep psychological scars in the form of post-traumatic stress disorder. It is my pleasure to welcome former Detective Sergeant Peter Ballion to Great Australian Lives. How are you, Peter?
I'm very well. Thank you, Laura, and thank you for inviting me along today.
We love hearing the real stories of people who are out there with their sleeves rolled up doing that, incredible work that you often don't get an insight into. You know, you might drive past what looks like a really terrible crash, or you'd see it on the news or read it in the paper, but you don't actually hear or understand as a layperson what is going on at that scene. And we'll get to that, your incredible work in a little while, and your career and how you've survived and battled chronic PTSD. But at the moment, I want to talk about you and what you're doing right now. I understand you're the IRB Captain Port Melbourne Lifesaving Club and Captain of the Huntingdale Golf Club. That's a different chapter in your life, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I've been in golf since about 11 years of age and been a member at Huntingdale for now 41 years. Gee. And the life-saving side of thing came about from all the kids when they were in primary school. Went through a beach program with Port Melbourne Lifesaving Club that was organised by mum and dad of one of the boys that my oldest son started primary school with. So dad's still doing work there, and all the kids have moved on, so to speak.
Would you have had a really busy summer? I mean, as a news reporter, I've covered a fair few incidents on the water. Have you been involved?
Actually, this summer has been a lot busier than previous. The last 3 years I've ended up doing over 200 hours or more voluntary service for the club, and received a gold recipient award from Lifesaving Victoria in regards to that service. But probably the first shift we ran with our COVID safe plan was Melbourne Cup Day, and because Melbourne Cup wasn't being held and it was a hot, warm day, there were thousands at the beach, and I actually did seven rescues in one shift that day. The first two were an 18-year-old and 19-year-old boy, one from New Zealand, one from Sydney, that there was a northerly wind, which is creating a current out towards the middle of the bay. As often happens, people see the yellow post 200 metres from shore, think, oh, yeah, I'm going to swim out to that, I can get out there, and then they turn around, the water's a little bit cool, and then realising they're swimming, like, into the current from the wind and get a bit tired. And I was out in the boat, saw the guy at the back struggling, and went over, grabbed him, and then his mate went a few more strokes and he said, can I help in too? So yeah, brought them back into shore safely. And then literally after getting them back into shore, again, it's still a northerly at that stage. So one of the other big problems with the northerly is you get a lot of younger people with flotation devices. So the next rescue was what we call a mass rescue, 8-year-old, 9-year-old and 11-year-old boys that were in a little inflatable raft. And before you knew it, they were 250 metres offshore, and the 11-year-old's got a plastic oar. And when I got out there to him, he was bawling his eyes out, trying to row it in. But as you know, even if you ever run out in petrol in the IRB, not that I've actually done that, maybe, when you try and row a boat back into against the northerly wind back into shore, it's just not happening. So I said, grab one of the handles on the side of the boat and brought them in, and Dad was standing in the shallows, unaware of really what had gone on. And by the time we got the kids back, they were all high-fiving and big smiles on their faces. And, so that was a really enriching moment, I would say. And then
I can imagine.
The last two rescues that day were very similar to the first two. So that was a brother and sister, similar thing. Swam out the 200, started to come back in, got into trouble. So, yeah. Our biggest risk down there is the jet skis. There's a lot of people that just ride them recklessly and too close to shore and too close to swimmers. And Saturday week ago, there was two guys on a jet ski came out of the marina at St Kilda way too fast in the watercraft exclusion zone. A couple of people swimming and then took off up to where we are and managed to corral them outside the 200-metre mark and followed at a slow pace and used a bit of camouflage technique of the red IRB hole against the red hole of the Spirit of Tasmania and got them in the shallows and got their ID and yeah, water police came across and dealt with them.
Gee, the lifesaving club's got an asset in you with your experience, don't they? I mean, all lifesavers are incredible in my eyes, but you come with a particular set of pretty good skills.
Yeah, well, being in that policing role, you know, you've got that sixth sense, you've got that natural hypervigilance, hyper-alertness, so you can see things evolving. And down there, you're able to, when you're on duty, you're actually able to take preventative action early on in the piece to make the situation, you know, obviously the last thing we want to do is be pulling somebody from the water unconscious. You know, I heard over the radio, I think it was Wednesday last week at Altona, that situation happened down there. There was a 23-year-old girl pulled from the water unconscious and they're doing CPR on the ground. And that's, you know, you don't want to be getting to that point. So if you can have that hyper-alertness, hyper-vigilance, which is works on your side, and you see things evolving and you can do the rescues, you know. So, yeah, there was two last year, you know, two 16-year-old boys from Hong Kong, you know, that were visiting in a yacht and they'd capsized about 800 metres off South Melbourne, actually. In South Melbourne, we're on duty and I'd sort of seen them from our clubhouse and so whizzed out there in the rescue boat. And luckily they both had life jackets on, but it was 80k northerlies gusting up to 100k, so it was pretty quick trip out there, but it was pretty rough coming back in. So yeah, things can happen very quickly on the bay. It's a dangerous piece of water if you don't prepare and plan.
Absolutely. Peter, I want to talk about the bigger reason why we're here, and that is your career and what led you to open up about suffering from PTSD, and that is, of course, the reason you've been labelled a hero over the years and your role in major collisions. For the layperson, I know I have a bit more of an insight than others being a news reporter, but there is incredible work that goes into reconstructing crash scenes. Can you explain why it's so important that we do understand and investigate them so thoroughly?
Yeah, a lot of time you don't necessarily have eyewitness testimony to a crash. You know, things, particularly a lot of the jobs that we would get, would be in the early hours of the morning where there's essentially maybe just two vehicles involved or a single vehicle off-road scenario. You know, that's happened at times when there's nobody else around. So all you've really got is you know, a number of people that might be very badly injured or killed, and you've got a scene there, and we've got to gather all that evidence. So we've got to, you know, photograph it, measure it, collect all the exhibits, you know, look at everything associated with the human factor, the vehicle factor, the environment factor, to try and work out exactly what's going on in this day and age.
What do you look at when you first get to a scene? What's the first things you look for?
Yeah, so when I would approach a scene, obviously you'd be given the original location. Generally the local police would be in attendance and ambulance. Not all the time. Sometimes I actually got to things first on, but you know, it's important to approach it slowly. And I would make notes of things that I would see along the route of the road, things like traffic signs, advisory signs, visual aspects of the road, delineation of the road, how clean, like reflectors might be on guideposts on the side of the road, how good are the line markings, all those sort of things. And then you'd progressively move into towards the scene. You obviously park the vehicle back from the start of the scene, and then, you know, have that slow walk along, examining that scene. And you know, people would say, probably the best person at seeing black tire marks on a black road at night time for a number of years. Still got 20/20 vision, luckily, but it's certainly a skill to be able to pick those tire marks up, and you have to have a bit of an understanding of vehicle dynamics too, as to what the type of behaviours vehicle do, and that comes from you know, doing reconstruction courses and learning about the physics of road crashes, and then as you go to more and more, you get more and more experience in assessing that evidence and putting it all together and putting plans together, and then using physics equations and momentum diagrams and vector diagrams and energy calculations and linear motion calculations and all this stuff to work out things. So yeah, it's a very interesting job. And then in the later stages, you know, you've got the airbag technology that you could download, which validates what we're doing for years. We do computer simulations and modelling of the crashes, and you know, with the distractive side of things with mobile phones, you know, the police have the ability to plug in and download the phones and get reverse CCR checks and CCR checks on and find out exactly what was going on in regards to telephones. Which is, it's a huge issue. Distraction and ice are the two biggest current issues. You know, speed and alcohol certainly were up there. They were 30% each for times, but alcohol's down around about 19%. Currently fatal collisions. But
and you're saying the drug ice?
Yeah, drug ice, yeah.
Right, and mobile phone use. Answer me this one question if you could. I remember as a reporter, often we'd turn up to a scene and we could often get quite close to the car, especially as a country reporter in the beginning of my career, and you can often see the speedometer is frozen.
Yeah, you'd get that sometimes.
But you can't trust that. Can you trust that that's how fast they were going?
No, not necessarily. It certainly does. It does happen, and there were cases where that had was corroborative of the speed that we'd worked out from, say, crush analysis to the car, and also post.
But it's not a telltale.
It's not always a telltale sign. No. Probably, you know, if you look as a rough estimate, it'd be around about a third of the cases where that happened, where it also corroborated. But the other times, it's stuck on at a different point in the movement of the vehicle post impact.
There you go. Incredible chat. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au, and more with former Detective Sergeant Peter Ballion in just a moment.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2021. Wishing you a safe and happy new year from the team at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
But let's change one small thing. At 60, the driver would have had more chance to see him properly. He'd have stayed in control and reached this point a moment later. The car would have cleared his path and he'd be home by now.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We just heard a snippet of the audio from one of the TAC's acclaimed Wipe Off 5 ad campaigns, which featured our guest tonight, Peter Ballion, who is a former detective sergeant with the Major Collisions Investigation Unit of Victoria Police. Now, Peter, we talked earlier about the way you reconstruct a crash scene, and I'm sure when you went into the role as an officer, you had some idea, you know, that that might be part of your career, but did you ever imagine you'd be fronting a TV campaign?
No, but effectively before I joined Victoria Police, I studied civil engineering, did a four-year degree at Caulfield, and in third year I specialised in traffic engineering when I got to meet back then who was Inspector David Roy Axhub, that's well and truly a familiar voice in past times gone by. David ended up retiring as a chief superintendent, but he came along and spoke to us about what the police do in regards to traffic engineering and accident investigation. That's what developed the interest in my third year. I went on to specialise in structural engineering as well, and in the final year had to do an investigation project. I did it on a review of speed limits on Victoria's roads. So I did a number of speed enforcement surveys covertly, looking at average speeds and 85th percentile traffic speeds, which is tends to be where you aim your enforcement levels at, and also looked at the accident rates on a lot of the roads I surveyed, and also did surveys with police presence, both covert and overt, or marked police vehicles and unmarked police vehicles. Ended up doing a report that went to Victoria Police, RACV, what was in Vic Roads or Roads Corporation, and there were 32 recommendations. All those recommendations were implemented, and one of them was the mass introduction of speed cameras. And the reason for that was back in that late 80s period, from a police perspective, cars weren't actually being stopped in, say, a 60-kilometre-per-hour urban environment until they were doing about 80 kilometres per hour or above, because you were actually flat out dealing with people doing that, because you know, you just in a one-on-one situation where you're speaking to somebody and then pulling them over and writing the infringement out, you know, it all took time. So you're flat out dealing with people by there. But when you look at the accident rates for those 60-kilometre-per-hour urban environments, you know, they're through the roof. Back in history, you look at we came from imperial to metric. So originally they were 35 miles per hour. If you do the conversion, it's actually 56 kilometres per hour. So it was a pretty bad mistake, if you'd like, to round it up to 60 kilometres per hour back in the days, you know, when metric came in. And now what we've got is a lot of, strip shopping centres are 40 kilometres per hour. We've got a lot of metropolitan collector roads that are, you know, 50 kilometre per hour limits. Things have changed. But to change that behaviour, initially there had to be something to deal with multiple offenders, and that was the recommendation in regards to the speed camera program. So a little bit of history.
Speed cameras cop a bit of flack, don't they?
They do, but they've saved a hell of a lives. Really. And a classic example is 1989 here in Victoria. There were 770 people killed on Victoria's roads. In 1990, it basically dropped to 500. So there are 270 less deaths in a 12-month period. At that point, let alone all the trauma associated with that and the ripple effect, you've also got a huge economic drain on the Victorian financial system, because the economic cost of per fatality back then was about $1.2 million. Mm. It's now well over $2 million per fatality death that costs the Victorian community.
Yep.
So it's a huge and the money that
what
actually
makes that up is that.
It's road closures, people being diverted, time delays, investigation, insurance payouts, death and disability payouts, court costs.
And then is it the ripple effect on the family of needing medical services, psychological care?
And also your first responders too, so over time.
Yeah. That's huge cost.
Yeah, so what basically happened, effectively, when those cameras were introduced, the tolerance was originally 10% plus 3. And so somebody going more than 69 in a 60 zone was photographed, and initially the prosecution rates were fairly high. It was up around 80% plus. But in a very, very short period of time, you know, obviously people would talk in social gatherings, oh, I got done, you know, I got a ticket come through the mail. Mm. People then, oh, shit, I better slow down a bit, you know.
Mm. So there was a
massive change in behaviour. And it saved a hell of a lot of lives, and we progressively came down a little bit more. You know, I think it was about 1997, we were down to about 397 deaths on the road, and it started to pick up a little bit. So I was asked to do a presentation, a statewide presentation to all our traffic people and TAC and all that were there. And I talked about what had happened previously, as we've just discussed, and just finished my last slide with what would happen if we wiped off another five. And effectively, that's John Thompson, who was marketing manager with TAC at the time. He was a driver behind that, getting it into the advertising program. And then they said they were going to put me in a couple of advertisements to illustrate that from a physics reality point of view. And that's where they evolved.
Well, it's a campaign that's certainly very popular, and I always think of it. The thing that got me... and whenever I feel tempted to speed is, I remember learning once that even if you go 5 or 10 k's over the limit, you only arrive about 3 minutes earlier or something.
Not even that.
Like, what's the
not
point?
Not even that. It's only seconds.
30 seconds or something.
Yeah, it's only seconds, and you put more wear and tear on your car, more fuel.
Yeah, what's the point?
You're getting stressed. Just chill out.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realise too. We've had those risk curves for drink driving. You've got, as a comparison, in a 60-kilometre-per-hour environment in the urban facility during the daytime when there's a lot of people and traffic around, 65 k's is the equivalent crash risk of having a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05.
Jeez.
And 80 k's in a 60-k zone is the equivalent crash risk of a blood alcohol concentration of 0.2, four times limit. So,
jeez.
That puts it into perspective, and that's something that I highlighted to 1,200 Navy recruits that I spoke to on road safety before they were let loose for the Christmas period, because they wanted them all back to make sure that they're available. So, a third of them are doing hotel quarantine duties at the moment.
Peter, now we mentioned in the intro that you've been very open about the fact that you suffer from PTSD. A fair while ago now, we had former homicide detective Narelle Fraser on the show.
Yes.
You'd probably be familiar with her. She described the effect of trauma as being like a drop in a cup, and each horrific incident you attend adds another drop to the cup until finally it sort of spills over.
Yep.
Would you agree with that analogy? I mean, you have investigated countless number of deaths of normal Victorians, but then on top of that, 2,000 fatalities, but 20 police deaths as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, six military officer deaths too.
That's enormous trauma. Would you agree with Narelle's analogy?
Yeah, you know, like just put the 2,000 into perspective. So during the Vietnam War, Australia lost 500 servicemen over there. So in terms of what I saw in death and destruction on Victoria's roads, and also did some work in other states and territories and a little bit overseas, you know, I was exposed to four times that amount of death and destruction. So obviously, you know, we have people that reflect and remember our military heroes and that, but your first responders are out there day in, day out, dealing with all sorts of things and putting their lives at risk day in, day out, and seeing horrific things out in our community. We're dealing with the 10%, I suppose, of society that are non-law compliant, and, you know, they do cause trauma, they do cause people to get injured, and you know, we're the ones that have to come along and clean all of that up. So each
do
one
you
go.
Remember, Peter, the first one you attended? The
first,
I mean, just
first
as
fatality?
A news reporter,
oh, yeah.
I remember the first
yeah, for
body
sure.
I saw,
yeah,
you, and
yeah.
it sounds terrible, but you, yeah. it probably sticks with you, that first one.
Yeah, so first motor vehicle fatality was at the intersection of Warrigal Road and Senator Dandenong Road in Cheltenham. I was on a constable on the van crew with Sergeant Peter Billing at the time, who went on to be a superintendent. And, yeah, we got a call sort of mid-morning there, and there was an elderly gentleman in a little red car that had been hit by an orange-coloured Ford F-150 utility, and you know, the elderly gentleman's car had been punted up Warrigal Road and was on the nature strip, and I remember seeing him in the car, and he had a bit of a gash on his head, and you know, he was talking, conversant and all that sort of stuff. And then you know, we did our investigation and of that of the incident. He went off to hospital coming the next day and found out that he'd passed away in hospital overnight. It was a hell of a shock, you know, because you just didn't expect it sort of thing. And that's one where, you know, I would use that as an example in training people, saying, you know, you've got to treat every collision you go to that it could potentially be fatal, because here's an example where just did not expect that, and then, you know, he's died in hospital overnight. So, that was the first of many. And the last was two school kids that were killed in a single vehicle crash runoff road up Wodonga Way. Dad was actually a former police officer, retired ill health, so he'd been treated for epilepsy. He'd been given the okay to get back behind the wheel, was picking up the kids from primary schools, had another seizure and gone off into the trees at over 100 k's, and just ripped the VX Commodore into three major bits. Pretty horrific. Yeah, that was.
Being a dad yourself, I mean, I cannot even begin to imagine how you digest that.
Yeah, there's certainly that. And then, you know, like I look back on the Kerrang rail disaster from, you know, the 5th of June 2007, I was first up there from our unit.
I'll stop you there, Peter. We're going to talk about Kerrang in depth next segment. But what I did want to ask you next, just to finish this segment, is about PTSD. 30% of first responders reportedly have it. I feel like it would be more than that.
That figure's coming from Austin Repatriation Hospital. So there's the Coral Balmoral Centre that's out there, and also you've got the Melbourne Clinic that run courses for post-traumatic recovery. Well, it's not exactly recovery. They teach you how to manage it and move on. You know, the physiological effects of what you've seen never really disappear. You know, it's just about learning how to manage it with medication and now other natural therapies, and bringing those wavelengths in so you can continue to function and operate in society and move on.
Incredible. We'll get back to more of that after this break. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And Tobin Brothers now offer fully live streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And of course, if our conversation with Peter Bellion has raised issues for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or visit lifeline.org.au. More in just a moment.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2021. Wishing you a safe and happy new year from the team at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
10 years on from the Kerrang rail disaster, families of the 11 victims say they're living with grief every day. Hundreds attended a memorial service in the northern Victorian town. Brett McLeod joined them.
Candles to shine a light in the darkness, one that still grips families of the 11.
It still haunts me to this day. I still can't believe it. Every time I see a level crossing, I close my eyes because I'm scared it's going to happen again.
On the afternoon of June 5, 2007, a V-Line train was travelling just north of Kerrang when a truck slammed into it at a level crossing. 11 people were killed and 23 injured. The truck driver, who said he saw no warning lights, was later charged but acquitted.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives, I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is former Detective Sergeant Peter Ballion. Peter, we heard there some of Brett McLeod's reporting on the 10th anniversary of the Kerrang train disaster. And for those listening who don't remember it, it was just a horrific incident and one in a spate of many level crossing disasters that were happening at that time. Correct me if I'm wrong, but did we lose 11 lives that night?
Yeah, well, it was actually in the afternoon. It was the 5th of June, Tuesday the 5th of June 2007, and about 1:30 in the afternoon the crash occurred, and
right.
There were 11 people killed in it. 10 of the people were in the second carriage of the three carriages that were attached to the diesel locomotive in 460. The 11th victim was in the last carriage, so effectively most of the side of the second carriage was torn open as a result of the impact from the truck and the prime mover and its trailer.
I remember one description being like it was like a can opener just peeling.
The
metal off the side of the train.
Yeah, it was very
shocking.
The injury mechanisms there were very, very similar to what had occurred on Melbourne Cup Day 1993, just north of Wangaratta too, where the car transporter had a spring failure on its steer axle and drifted across into a northbound passenger coach and tore the side of that open, killing 9 in the impact and a 10th from asphyxiation. Mm. So the Kerrang job opened a lot of, I suppose if you like, war wounds from Wangaratta as well, and I would describe the second carriage at Kerrang and also the coach at Wangaratta, because if you imagine them on their side, it looks like a trench. Effectively, it would look like a trench where bombs have gone off and just bits everywhere. So that's what it was like.
Then you mentioned earlier on when we were talking that you got there pretty early, didn't you?
On the day, I'd just come back in from court, one of my second homes at that point in time, giving evidence quite a bit. And I'd driven into Dawson Street. Mick Talbot, the senior sergeant, had rung, I think, on the way back when I was coming up Royal Parade. And so I literally pulled into the driveway. I had everything ready to go. And I said, look, well, I'll head up in the car and I'll do all the comms and organise services in the car on the way up. And then Trevor Collins and Jeff Draper, they went out to the air wing and then got in the chopper. So I was actually on the road at the scene as Jeff and Trevor were circling over above in the police helicopter doing the aerial photographs of the scene before landing. So, so I basically did all that initial action that we do, trying to find out where everybody was. There was one of the victims was lying on the side of the road and all the rest were basically in the carriages. The truck driver had been taken hospital, so organised in regards to what was going on with him in terms of blood sampling and welfare checks and medical checks and potential to be interviewed, and also, you know, gathering all the witnesses' details and what police units were there and what ambulance units and all that was. So it's pretty full on, those, bit like the Burnley Tunnel job, you know. We had 400 people at the western entrance of the Burnley Tunnel, and you're trying to sort out who's what, who's witnesses, who's victims, who's not involved, and who's the offender, sort of thing.
Amidst all that, Peter, you're a dad, you're a human being, you're an unbelievably professional police officer, but you're looking at lives that have been extinguished almost before your eyes. How do you protect yourself? Is it adrenaline? Do you put a game face on?
You do. Effectively, what's occurring is no human being's designed to do what our military or first responders do, or our nurses or doctors. You're seeing things that the normal person doesn't get to see. So the way your body actually helps you attend and deal with those things is there's a thing in the brain called the amygdala that controls your body's fear flight, and it's responsible for releasing adrenaline and cortisol into your body, which allows you to respond to it. And as a recruit, young recruit, you'll have drill instructors yell commands at you and get you to work through that fear flight. But initially, as you go to more and more and more, as you said about Narelle, describing it. Each job you go to, you're doing a detailed statement, so you've got a lot of information being stored in the hippocampus, the memory part of the brain, about that job, day, date, time, places, weather conditions, road conditions, vehicle descriptions.
I mean, you were talking about the first one you attended and you recalled the colours of the cars.
It's so
obvious.
It was a good trait to assist the other members at the office, because if there was any job that they went to and it was a similar job to something I'd been to in the past, I was able to recall and guide them and that in. But in hindsight, it's also probably something that's exacerbated the PTSD for me. That part of the memory is so strong. I take a lot of photographs now of things I like doing, put them up on social media. I'm trying to rewrite the imagery or the schema in the brain to rewrite those tracks in the brain to eradicate those memories from the past,
Gee, that's a really fascinating way of doing that. And I know that Kerrang really exacerbated your PTSD, didn't it?
That's when I was officially diagnosed with it. But the first effects of what I now know was probably went back to 26th of April 05. On the 24th of April 05, we'd had Tony Clark shot and killed on duty on the Warburton Highway. And on the Tuesday morning, the 26th, I was sitting in the office doing the post-plan processing of Tony's scene, assisting Peter Holland, one of our other investigators, with that. Then we got the call to go up to Benalla at the 200k post there, where Rennie had been hit by a driver that had basically had a microsleep 2 hours into a trip from Melbourne and drifted left, and cleaned him up in the emergency lane and as a pedestrian. Freeway speed 110k, so 110k's car into a pedestrian's not a good day.
Horrific. You've touched on medication and some therapies and even the way you photograph things now. Are they the main ways that you manage your illness today?
There's a number of things. So obviously the first step was medication, and there's been various control of dosages at various times. So an example of during the recent COVID lockdown, I ended up having to go from 20 milligram up to 60 milligram of my morning medication, because I didn't have my social outlets like the life-saving
and the golf
club. Currently back on 40 milligrams. So, things sort of got a little bit off kilter a bit, and the physiological effects of it were a little bit worse. There was a lot more shaking of an evening, around dinner time, which would typically be news time. Sitting there eating dinner, you'd get a dump of the adrenaline from a memory or a flashback that might be prompted by something popping up on the TV, and you just get these body shakes and you're almost falling out of the chair.
Do you still watch the news?
Occasionally, not very often. I'm sometimes, not really. Mostly you'd social media sort of stuff these days that I look at.
Yeah.
It's things that I want to look at.
What advice do you have for other people who might think they have PTSD, or what are the signs that, people might see within themselves that you'd think would be important to get checked?
Initially, you'll have trouble sleeping. You'll be waking in a startled response in the early hours of the morning or night. Heart rate will be going, you'll be sweating, you might have some skin irritations occurring. So I ended up with 20% or one-fifth of my body area is covered with psoriasis, which is from too much cortisol being released into your body. I initially was getting up at 3-4 o'clock in the morning and doing 30k bike rides, 10k runs, pumping weights, all this sort of stuff, not really knowing why. But what you're actually doing is trying to burn off all that adrenaline in your system and get rid of it, and then going into work. Sort of then other things are, you might have a little bit of a short fuse, you might be some anger, getting frustrated or angry about things that wouldn't have previously got you frustrated or angry. For example, I would, when I was giving evidence in court, you'd be sweating through your shirt underneath your tunic and all that sort of stuff, which is, your body's working overtime, and you do it. And then all of a sudden you'd come out of the witness box and have this sort of hyperventilating sort of effect, and then you'd come home from court and you're just totally drained, you're just totally worn out, and it was a bit like that and also the jobs, and then you're just totally and physically exhausted because you've been operating at this really, really high level, and then you got the post job or post court phase, and that's where with the PTSD that hypervigilance level becomes an anxiety response in your system, and then the post-job phase becomes a depressive response system. So the first step in treating PTSD is to actually go and get assistance and get the medication to bring those goalposts back in. And then you can do another number of other natural things like breathing control, progressive muscle relaxation skills, meditation, download apps on your phone like Calm and Breathe and do those things, do a progressive body scan to calm all your system down. I do a lot of Pilates band training, a lot of strengthening and flexibility of all different muscle groups in the body.
Yeah, I've seen some of the videos,
actually. Yeah, because the sort of toxins can build up in your body when you get the physiological shakes, you know. I quite often get remedial massage done through, you know, the health fund to try and get rid of all those knots in your muscle systems. I've got a foam roller I'm roll on quite regularly to take the tension out of your muscle groups. I do the float therapy in a pod. It's really good because it takes all the tension off your back, and you can do like a deep meditation that calms the mind, and the salts that are in those baths also good for the treatment of the psoriasis. And that's one of the reasons why, with the life-saving too, you've got the sun, so plenty of vitamin D, which is on your eyelids. So it's natural serotonin, which is one of the ingredients of antidepressant medication. And you've got the salt water, which helps the psoriasis too. So,
sounds like you've got a lot of strings to your bow then.
yeah. Keep busy. And the golf's good too, because you're out in the sunlight walking around and smelling the fresh air and getting that sort of low-level exercise, but it's good exercise. You know, you round a golf, you're burning off about 2,000 calories, whereas you go for an hour of bike ride with your mates, it's only about 1,000 calories, so play golf.
Well, there you go. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And of course, if any of tonight's episode has raised issues for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. There is more with Peter Ballion in just a moment.
You're listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2021. Wishing you a safe and happy new year from the team at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is former Detective Sergeant Peter Ballion, who in his time with the Major Collision Investigation Unit of Victoria Police attended some 2,000 fatalities and 20 police deaths. He's a survivor of chronic post-traumatic stress disorder who now shares his harrowing story to help others. I want to thank you for doing that, Peter, not to to blow your trumpet, but lots of people keep that inside, and it's so important. Everyone's struggling with something. It's so important to hear people talk about their struggles, not put on that tough Aussie bloke thing that's so outdated. So, yeah, thank you for doing that. I know that golf and surf life-saving is a big part of your life and your therapy now. Now that we're not stuck in our houses, what does 2021 hold for you?
Certainly, but getting out a lot more like we were beforehand. It's been good to get back into, the golf and the life-saving side of things. You know, one of the important aspects of managing PTSD is to get out and about and socialise again, so you're not stuck in on your own. Yeah, because that's when the brain will tip back into things you've gone into the past. During that period of time, you'd go for a bit of a walk with the dog, or go for a bit of a walk, but you weren't covering as many kilometres when you wouldn't really see anybody. So
you're only covering 5 kilometres.
Yeah. And, whereas around the golf course, it's about 10Ks every time you play. So,
yeah. You've talked earlier about all the different things you do to assist with therapy, but you didn't mention one thing I know you love, and that's building model aeroplanes. And that must be really good for the brain.
It's sort of my art therapy, I suppose. And I'm in a couple of groups with there are other guys that are either military or first responders, so it's a bit like a men's shed type situation.
Yeah.
Build something up, bring it along, have a bit of a social chit-chat, and they're all good blokes. You know, they've done time and service in various roles, and some modelers we refer to as rivet counters that get a bit carried away with the super detail on it, but these guys are just, a lot of them are just building it for their own enjoyment. We enjoy seeing what each other's has built, and it's a chance to get out and socialise rather than not, as we said
and
earlier.
You'd be a group of people who'd really understand each other, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And it's, there's it's a chance for the guys, if there's something going on, you know, they'll open up and talk about some situations that might be evolving in their work life or home life at that present point in time, where they might not necessarily do otherwise if they weren't involved in something like that.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so very much for being a guest on our show and sharing some of your harrowing but uplifting stories as well as to how you've helped yourself and are helping others. So thank you.
Thanks, Laura. And it's my message is really, I've seen a lot, but you can learn to manage it and you can move on. And if with what I've seen, if I'm able to continue on and function and still do some important roles in society, anybody can do it. But the main thing is if you are struggling, don't get into the piss or the drugs or the alcohol and the drugs.
Yep.
Put your hand up, get some assistance. You can manage it and you can move on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope anyone listening tonight who might be struggling with some symptoms of PTSD heeds your message there. Thank you, Peter Bellion. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Laura.
If you've enjoyed our chat with Peter Bellion tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another Great Australian Life.
Thanks for listening to the best of Great Australian Lives for 2021. Wishing you a safe and happy new year from Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.